Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Mason Wilrich. I'm director of the California Clean Energy Fund and a longtime Commonwealth Club member. Now it's my distinct honor and also a personal pleasure for me to introduce Robert S. Mueller, the sixth director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Nominated by President George W. Bush, he was sworn in to lead the FBI on September 4, 2001, just 1 week before the Al-Qaeda attacks on 9/11. Under his leadership, the FBI has since played the leading role in preventing further terrorist attacks inside America. All Americans should be happy that Congress recently approved an extension of his 10-year term as director for an additional 2 years. I've known Bob since 1970, which was his first year as a law student at University of Virginia, where I was on the law school faculty. He was a returning veteran from the Vietnam War, having led a rifle platoon in the 3rd Marine Division, receiving a Bronze Star, Purple Heart, and Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry. I was always on the lookout for incoming students who played squash. Bob more than filled that bill. He improved my game, although I never, never beat the man. I did, however, get to know him very well. He was a prince. Bob also was smart enough for me to offer him a job as my research assistant and dumb enough to accept. He was a delight to work with, and together we produced an article, The Energy-Environment Conflict, Citing Electric Power Facilities, which was published in 1972. When Bob graduated from UVA, he left a real hole in my life, but I knew for sure he was going to accomplish great things. We kept in touch as his career progressed until FBI swallowed him in 2001. Bob's legal career has been mainly in public service with interruptions for private practice, all of it focused on criminal law, financial fraud, public corruption, narcotics, conspiracies, money laundering, terrorists. He first became well known in San Francisco, where he served in the U.S. Attorney's Office, rising to be chief of the criminal division. Thereafter, he moved to Boston as assistant U.S. attorney, and then to the U.S. Justice Department in Washington, where he led the criminal division. In 1998, Bob returned to San Francisco as United States attorney. Please join me in welcoming my good friend and one of America's most distinguished public servants, Robert Mueller.
Well, let me start off by thanking you, Mason, for that kind introduction. I will say it. You often wonder when a former professor is going to introduce you. You don't know what's going to come out. But thank you. You were there to kickstart my career when it needed kickstarting. And let me thank the Commonwealth Club for having me back. It's great to be back in San Francisco, but also to be back with you this afternoon. 2 months ago, we marked the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks. And the horrific events of that day were the prelude to a decade of political, economic, and cultural transformation, and globalization and technology have accelerated these changes. And consider now how different our world was in the summer of 2001. The leaders of Egypt, Iraq, and Libya were entrenched in power. Barack Obama was an Illinois state senator, and Arnold Schwarzenegger was a movie actor. 10 years ago, most Americans had never heard of a credit default swap or mortgage-backed securities. Lehman Brothers had celebrated its 150th anniversary, and in 2001, Mark Zuckerberg was captain of his high school fencing team. Borders Bookstores had $3 billion in annual revenue, and meanwhile, Kindle was something you did to a fire, and Nook was merely a small corner of the room. And back then, most Americans knew little about Osama bin Laden or Al-Qaeda. And at the time, I was the U.S. attorney here in San Francisco, as Mason pointed out, and I myself, being out here, paid little attention to those terrorist attacks that were occurring overseas. Today, our world can change in the blink of an eye, and the effects of that change are felt more rapidly and more broadly than ever before. Consider the current economic climate. When companies fail to recognize and adapt to change, they can go out of business almost overnight. And law enforcement and the intelligence community face a similar challenge. If we in the FBI fail to recognize how the world is changing, the consequences can be devastating, lives can be lost, our national security can be threatened, and the balance of power can tip toward our adversaries. Terrorism, espionage, and cyber attacks are now the FBI's top priorities. Terrorists, spies, and hackers are always thinking of new ways to harm us. And today I want to discuss how these threats are evolving and want to share with you what the FBI is doing to stay one step ahead to keep our nation safe, prosperous, and free. So let's begin with the terrorist threat. During the past decade, we have weakened Al-Qaeda due to the coordinated efforts of our military, the intelligence community, law enforcement, and our international partners. We have captured or killed many Al-Qaeda leaders and operatives, including Osama bin Laden and Anwar al-Awlaki. We have shut down terrorist training camps, frozen their finances, disrupted their communications, and most importantly, we have uncovered dozens of cells and prevented terrorist attacks. And yet, core Al-Qaeda operating out of Pakistan remains committed to high-profile attacks against the West. We confirmed this with a record seized from bin Laden's compound after his death. And we saw this with a plot by Najibullah Zazi to bomb the New York subway system in 2009. And meanwhile, Al-Qaeda affiliates have emerged as significant threats. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, operating in Yemen, has attempted several attacks on the United States, including the failed Christmas Day airline bombing in 2009 and the attempted bombing of U.S.-bound cargo planes in October of 2010. And most recently, we have a growing concern about the threat from homegrown violent extremists. These individuals have no typical profile. Their experiences and motives are often distinct, but they are increasingly savvy and willing to act alone, which makes them difficult to find and to stop. The recent case of Hossam Smadi is but one example. In 2009, Smadi was a 19-year-old Jordanian citizen living in Texas. And although he espoused loyalty to bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, Smadi was not affiliated with any group or other would-be terrorists. He had become radicalized on his own on the Internet. And when Smadi expressed a clear interest in attacking a Dallas skyscraper, the FBI used undercover agents to set up a sting. Three agents who spoke Arabic began talking with Smadi, first online and then later in person. He believed he had found an Al-Qaeda sleeper cell to assist him. And after months of planning, Smadi parked what he believed was a truck bomb underneath the skyscraper and dialed a cell number he thought would detonate the bomb. But the bomb was a fake, supplied by our undercover agents, and the call signaled the agents to make the arrest. And last year, Smadi was convicted and sentenced to 24 years in prison. Intelligence led us to Smadi, and the combined efforts of our federal, state, and local partners helped to stop him before he could do any harm. And in the face of this threat, we in the Bureau will continue to enhance our intelligence capabilities to get the right information to the right people at the right time. And we will continue to build strong partnerships, for these tools have been the foundation for our success against terrorism over the past 10 years. We must keep adapting to these changing terrorist threats to stay one step ahead of those who would do us harm. And we must do all of this while respecting the rule of law and the safeguards guaranteed by the Constitution. Now let us turn from terrorists to spies. Many people assume the end of the Cold War made the world of cloak and dagger obsolete, but unfortunately espionage is still very much with us. Nations will always try to learn one another's secrets to gain political, military, or economic advantage. Indeed, the foreign intelligence presence operating in the United States today is roughly the same as it was during the Cold War. We still confront traditional espionage, such as spies working under diplomatic cover or even posing as ordinary citizens. Consider the arrest last year of 10 agents of the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service. Many of you may have seen TV news stories and videos covering the techniques we used in our investigation, which was codenamed Ghost Stories. And it did feature the stuff of a John Le Carré novel, dead drops in train tunnels, brush passes at night, and clandestine meetings in cafes. But apart from the more traditional types of espionage, today's spies are just as often students, researchers, business people, or operators of front companies. And they seek not only state secrets, but trade secrets from corporations and universities, such as research and development, intellectual property, and insider information. Consider the recent case of Nasheer Gawadia, a naturalized U.S. citizen from India. For 18 years, he was an engineer at Northrop Grumman, the defense contractor that built the B-2 stealth bomber, one of our nation's most important strategic assets. Gawadia decided to offer his knowledge of sensitive military secrets to anyone who is willing to pay for it. He sold highly classified information about the B-2's stealth technology to several nations, including China. He also made 6 covert trips to China to assist them in development of stealth technology for their cruise missiles. Partnerships, again, were essential in finding and stopping Gawadia before he could further damage national security. And together with the Air Force, U.S. Customs, IRS, and other agencies, we built a strong case against him. And this past January, he was sentenced to 32 years in prison. Foreign spies know that military superiority is merely one factor that determines the world's balance of power. Just as important is the kind of economic innovation we find here in the Bay Area. And so it is no surprise that spies also target the most valuable secrets of American companies, as well as universities. They hope that stealing the fruits of American innovation will give their nations a shortcut to economic preeminence. An example of the cost of this type of espionage. Last month, Kujue Wong, a former scientist for 2 of America's largest agricultural companies, pled guilty to charges that he sent trade secrets to his native China. While working at Dow AgriSciences and later at Cargill, Huang became a research leader in biotechnology and the development of organic pesticides. And although he had signed non-disclosure agreements, he transferred stolen trade secrets from both companies to persons in Germany and China, and his criminal conduct cost Dow and Cargill millions of dollars. These two cases illustrate the growing scope of what we call the insider threat, when employees use their legitimate access to steal secrets for the benefit of another company or another country. Add to this that so much sensitive data is now stored on computer networks, our adversaries often find it as effective or even more effective to steal secrets through cyber intrusions. Foreign spies have increased their skill at exploiting weaknesses in our computer networks, and once inside, they can exfiltrate government and military secrets, as well as valuable intellectual property, information that can improve the competitive advantage of state-owned companies. Earlier this month, the intelligence community issued a report to Congress stating that cyber-based economic espionage is increasingly pervasive, and the report confirms that several nations are using cyber capabilities to collect sensitive American technology as well as economic secrets. And while state-sponsored cyber espionage is a growing problem, it is but one aspect of the cyber threat. The number and the sophistication of computer intrusions have increased dramatically in recent years. American companies are using billions of dollars worth losing billions of dollars worth of intellectual property, research and development, as well as trade secrets. And outside attackers burrow into the company networks, remain undiscovered for months or even years. It's much like having termites in your house. Often by the time you discover them, the damage is done. And now hacktivist groups are pioneering their own forms of digital anarchy. And here in the Bay Area, you witness their work firsthand when individuals hack the BART website and release personal data of BART customers. And we also must consider that hostile nations or terrorist groups could launch cyber attacks against our critical infrastructure. And the anonymity of the Internet makes it difficult to discern the identity, the motives, and the locations of an intruder. And the proliferation of portable devices that connect to the Internet only increases the opportunity to steal vital information. And we in the FBI cannot merely react to computer intrusions. Hackers will seek to exploit every vulnerability, and we must be able to anticipate their moves. Let me share one example with you. In April, the FBI brought down an international botnet known as CoreFlood. Botnets are those networks of virus-infected computers controlled remotely by an attacker. And to shut down CoreFlood, the Bureau took control of 5 servers the hackers had used to infect some 2 million computers with malware. This malware allowed the hackers to steal personal and financial information by recording the user's keystrokes. But we not only shut down the servers, we took another unprecedented step. With court approval, the FBI responded to signals sent from infected computers in the United States, and we sent those computers a command that stopped the malware, preventing harm to hundreds of thousands of users. If you step back, you can see that surveying today's threats is somewhat like peering into a kaleidoscope, when even the slightest rotation creates new patterns of color and light. And just when it seems you understand a threat, the world turns and the threat has changed. As Tom Friedman has described in his book, The World is Flat, advances in technology, travel, commerce, and communications have broken down barriers between nations and between individuals. Globalization has had a flattening effect, leveling the playing field for all of us. And this hyperconnectivity is empowering and engaging people around the world, both friend and foe alike. And so how do we stay ahead of terrorist spies and hackers? Intelligence will continue to drive our investigations. We must ask ourselves, what do we know about these threats? What are the gaps in our intelligence? And what human sources can we develop to cultivate to fill these gaps. Each of us, government leaders, business executives, and everyday citizens alike, must ask ourselves what vulnerabilities we may have overlooked. And we must also place even greater emphasis on partnerships and information sharing. No single agency, no single company, no single nation can defeat these complex global threats alone. And in these days of tight budgets, working together is essential. It is the only way to work. And finally, we need the right tools and capabilities to address shifting threats. For example, the foreign language skills we used to stop Hassan Smadi and the advanced cyber capabilities we used to shut down the CoreFlood botnet. And so another critical tool is the FBI's ability to intercept electronic communications. Many social networking conduits, in contrast to traditional communications carriers, are not able now to produce the electronic communications we seek in response to a court order. And when investigators cannot collect communications pursuant to court order in near real time, they may not be able to act quickly enough to disrupt threats to protect public safety. Laws covering this area have not been updated since 1994, a lifetime ago in the Internet age. And so we are working with Congress, the courts, our law enforcement partners, and the private sector to ensure that our ability to intercept communications is not eroded by advances in technology. One last but very important point. The FBI has always adapted to meet new threats. And we must continue to evolve because terrorists, spies, and hackers certainly will. But our values can never change. Regardless of emerging threats, the impact of globalization, or changing technology, the rule of law will remain the FBI's guiding principle. In the end, we know that we will be judged not only by our ability to keep Americans safe, but also by whether we safeguard the liberties for which we are fighting, and maintain the trust of the American people. Yes, our adversaries are persistent, they are clever, and the pressures of globalization and technology are ever present. Change is a constant in today's world, and we must prepare for it. And yet change is just one constant. The other is the American people's resolve to defend our freedom and our way of life. The same resolve drives the FBI every day. And together we can and we will keep our country safe from harm. Thank you again for having me here today, and I certainly would be happy to answer whatever questions you might have.
Our thanks to Director Mueller. I'm Mariano Florentino Cuellar. I direct the Stanford Center for International Security and Cooperation, and I'm a professor at Stanford Law School, and I'm very honored to be here today to moderate our question and answer session. I'm also very glad that I'm not the one having to answer these questions. Director, I wonder if we could start with a pair of questions about 9/11. There were many questions from the audience about 9/11, and I'll just pair these two together. The first part of it is, on the day itself, as you recall what you went through and what your team went through, what did you learn about the FBI that you did not know before? And then the second part of the question is much more of a retrospective, asking 10 years looking back now, how do the FBI and the CIA relate to each other differently than they did before?
Well, and, I'd started, as Mason pointed out, the week before. So I didn't know, I could barely find my office on September 11th. But what happens, the FBI's history of over 100 years, and the fact of the matter is the FBI kicked in, as it always does, in a tragedy and a disaster such as you saw on September 11th. And I was along for the ride, but they did a phenomenal job. The deputy, Tom Picard, ran the show. We were up and running within minutes, certainly hours, of what happened on the morning of September 11th. And the operation, even though it was the most extensive in the Bureau's history, ran exceptionally smoothly. The key point came, I did get a call from the President that day, as I recall, saying, certainly somewhere early afternoon, saying, we can't let this happen again. But the formative, perhaps the most formative moment came several days later when I was briefing the president, one of the first at times. And I started off the briefing, the president, vice president, and others, and by saying, with the FBI, we've set up command centers at the Pentagon and up in New York, and we are tracking the individuals who were responsible for this. We've identified a number by their seats on the planes, and I was about 2 minutes into it, and the president stopped me and said, Bob, what you're telling me is what I expect the Bureau to do. That's investigate after the fact. You've been doing it for 100 years. I expect you to accomplish that. What I want to know from you today is what you and the FBI are doing to prevent the next terrorist attack. And for us in the Bureau, who are used to being reactive and doing cases, myself as a prosecutor is used to getting a case, prosecuting and putting people away, the mission to prevent a terrorist attack was something new, which gave rise to the development of an intelligence capacity, breaking down of the walls between ourselves and CIA, NSA, and the intelligence community. But always in the back of our mind, I think just about everybody in the Bureau had in the back of their mind, we cannot let this happen again. It's insufficient to investigate after the fact. That's not what the president was asking. And on that day, I felt like that high school student who got the wrong assignment when the president asked that question. But it's been in the back of my mind since that time. And each president, whether it be President Bush or President Obama, foremost on their mind is protecting the American public from another attack.
We have a number of questions that deal with mission areas that you did not mention specifically, given the importance, of course, of cybersecurity and espionage and counterterrorism. But I wonder if you could say a little bit about two things, maybe. One is what your sense is of where the country is with respect to drug policy. The FBI, of course, is involved in drug policy along with other law enforcement agencies. But also more generally, how you approach the challenge of managing this broad range of responsibilities that the FBI has to continue to attend to while at the same time prioritizing the missions that you mentioned?
Well, it's the last word that you used, which is most effective, prioritization. We early on realized that we needed a set of priorities and needed to focus on those priorities. The three priorities we talked about today, terrorism, counterterrorism, counter-espionage, and cyber, the three national security priorities, and they were 1, 2, and 3. On the criminal side, we established public corruption and civil rights were the top two priorities, because if the FBI did not address those priorities, they often would not be addressed. Transnational, international, organized crime, because organized crimes cuts across various jurisdictions, became the third criminal priority. White-collar crime, I have the Enrons, the WorldCom, the HealthSouths back then, the mortgage fraud crises now. White-collar crime is number 4, and number 5 was violent crime. You'll see left off that list are a number of things, including the drug cases that we had traditionally done previously. But when we say priority, we meant priority. The special agent in charge, Stephanie here, knows that you have to address those priorities in order. I moved almost 2,000 agents from the criminal programs to counterterrorism and national security because that was the priority. And so we have, since September 11th, been run according to a set of priorities that we continuously review, but precludes us from doing things that we had traditionally done, we all enjoyed doing, but is not as necessary to be done as the priorities that we have identified. And we're fairly rigorous in terms of when it comes to budget, when it comes to personnel, we adhere to those priorities. And in a tighter budget, those are the things that save you because you go down the priorities and you're able to make the decisions somewhat better than you otherwise would. So we're not doing as much in the battle against on the war on drugs that we did before. It's a continuous battle. We do participate in a number of ways, and it is a war and a battle worth fighting.
We have a number of questions about cybersecurity. The question that emerges, of course, in the minds of many people is how the FBI might approach the challenge of balancing the security-related imperatives that it has in cybersecurity with concerns about privacy and civil liberty. So I wonder if you could speak to that in the cyber context, but also perhaps maybe what you think Americans should be thinking about as they ask the question of what their government should be prepared to do in terms of offensive operations in cyberspace.
Well, let me first of all define the FBI's role with more particularity. Generally, we do investigate. Our primary function is when there's intrusion, we're called in, we investigate. We have very adept investigators who have been doing this for a period of time. The problem with a cyber intrusion attack is you have no idea whether it's another government sponsored attack or an organized criminal attack or originating in Russia or Romania or wherever by an organized crime group, or the high school student who's down the block up in his room undertaking a cyber attack. And consequently, the way we divide up our work, you know, espionage or terrorism or fraud, doesn't really help us when you have an intrusion, particularly if it's an intrusion from overseas by a foreign government, which falls under the purview of the intelligence agencies, our foreign intelligence agency, NSA, CIA, and the like. So what we have found is we have had to adjust our organizational structure to develop the relationships and put together task forces when there's a cyber intrusion that includes individuals from across the community, because you don't know where that case is going to end up and you want to make certain you don't miss anything. And so whether it be offensive or defense, so we are generally defensive in the sense that operating domestically and the investigative authority within the United States. But we would be helpless if we did not work with DHS, CIA, NSA, and the rest of the intelligence community. And if there is one substantial change that has made the biggest difference to safety and security over the last 10 years, I would say breaking down the walls between the traditional walls between the intelligence community and the domestic law enforcement community, because information flows very easily over borders now, and you cannot just see one piece of the puzzle without getting the other piece of the puzzle. It has made a tremendous difference and has given rise to the approach from all of us is, okay, we want to work together with you in a task force context.
For our radio listeners, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is FBI Director Robert Mueller, who is discussing security threats concerning the United States. Would like to ask you a little bit about the national security implications of our energy policy, an issue of much concern in the news and certainly here in Silicon Valley. So what might you say about the relationship between energy policy and some of the national security challenges that the FBI is addressing?
Well, one of the nice things about my job is I generally stay away from policy. But when it comes to energy resources and like it, there are a number of, you can look at it from the geopolitical perspective, which is not something that really bears on what we do day in and day out. If you put in context the potential of cyber attacks and the concerns we have about cyber attacks on our infrastructure, there's an intersection between the vulnerabilities we have in our energy and electrical grids and the like from cyber attacks, which keep all of us busy. Let me just go back to one other thing that I did not address in the question before, and that is the balance between privacy interests, civil rights interests, and the like, and the necessity to address these threats. Every day there is a balance between what we need to undertake to do our job and to prevent the results of a substantial terrorist attack. But every one of us understands it is a balance, and particularly the Bureau over the years has understood that in conducting investigations you need predication, you need start, and then you build up predication before you take the next investigative step that may further intrude on one's privacy and the like. I will tell you that our agents are inculcated with the understanding that they're given a great deal of power, a great deal of ability to affect persons' lives. And is that balance that, and understanding the necessity of operating within the Constitution, within the applicable statutes, the Attorney General guidelines that is drilled into all of our new agents as they come out of new agents class. And as I've indicated before, my predecessor, Louis Free, set up a process whereby every one of our agents goes through the Holocaust Museum to make certain that they understand what can happen when there is a law enforcement or intelligence agency that gets off the tracks.
You addressed one of my upcoming questions, but there was a variation on it that I thought might be interesting just to share with you, and I'll just quote it directly here. It says, "What recourse do ordinary citizens have to hold government officials accountable?"
Well, we have internally, we have our own inspection divisions that monitors what we do and takes complaints both outside and inside and reviews it, and we've got a privacy officer. We have an inspector general in the Department of Justice. We fall within the Department of Justice. And I will tell you that Congress is not shy in exercising its oversight of the FBI and other federal agencies. So it's not as if we are not scrutinized. and persons who have complaints. There are a number of opportunities, a number of offices that will handle those, whether it be inside the FBI, inside the Department of Justice, the Inspector General's office, or the Hill.
Thank you. If I had a dollar for every question that I have here that mentions the word occupy, I'd probably be a rich man. And I should note for a moment that I greatly appreciate how much time and thought people have put into these questions. They're very good questions. I'm trying my best to get to as many of them as I can, and also to group them together when several of you mentioned common themes. So some of the questions about Occupy are about Occupy San Francisco. How should city police deal with the encampments? I'm guessing you're probably going to stay away from that one.
One thing you do learn after 10 years is how to duck a question. And so even if you ask it, I'm ducking it.
Fair enough. But
I think you got a very good police force here, very competent persons, and so it is in their bailiwick, they do a very good job.
So I might then follow up by asking you the more general question, because the Occupy protests, of course, have been going on in several cities and have garnered a great deal of attention from any number of sources and quarters. And so I guess the general question would be, what is your impression of what is happening, of the challenges that might be represented there, not only for law enforcement, but for the country?
I'm not going to get weighed too deep in these waters, I can tell you, other than to say it's difficult, present very difficult issues. On the one hand, First Amendment rights and expressing those First Amendment rights. On the other hand, the right for ordinary citizens to have the ability to access venues in their city. And it's worked out, reading as you do from the newspapers, worked out somewhat differently depending on the city and the circumstances.
And now for something much easier. Let's talk about Pakistan.
That's a law professor thinking that's easier. Go ahead.
So a number of our questioners note that it seems to be public record that there have been some challenges in the relationship between our government and Pakistan, and yet Pakistan continues to be an important strategic partner, an ally, and in a very complicated region. Would love to hear you speak a little bit about how you see that relationship with respect to our law enforcement activities and what you think we might expect in that relationship going forward.
You know, people, it's interesting because in today's world of globalization, you find, I think when I was started as an assistant United States attorney here in San Francisco back in the late 1970s, I probably had one case that had some ramifications outside of this district. And now I'd say it's probably the reverse. 9 out of 10 cases intersect with persons in other jurisdictions, whether it be within the United States or internationally. And what happens is, regardless of whether it's Pakistan or a number of countries that you could mention, where we have diverging interests, there are also interests that pull us together. In Pakistan, we've got good relationships at a number of levels. It's a much more difficult relationship at perhaps the higher levels. But we still have good relationships with certain counterparts over there, as we do with a number of countries. I can not praise enough the work that's been done by our sister agencies, it be a DOD or CIA, NSA, and the like, in addressing the threat of terrorism worldwide. We are safer today as a country because of the efforts that have been undertaken by those entities, whether it be in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and other areas around the world.
Director, there's been a lot of attention both inside in government and outside government involving with respect to the issue of what might be done about the motivations of people who engage in terrorist activity or are recruited by terrorist organizations. I wonder if you could speak a little bit to how you, whether you see efforts to do something about this to be promising in terms of outreach or better relations with particular communities, what questions you think are important for us to answer to be able to better get a handle on what motivations people have for engaging in terrorist action.
I would say that the landscape has shifted over the last 4 or 5 years. Where 4 or 5 years ago, our greatest concern would be radicalization from individuals in Pakistan or Yemen and other individuals or acolytes here in the United States who would reach out and touch somebody and recruit them for to go to Yemen or work with Al-Shabaab in Somalia or Pakistan. What has happened over the last several years, as I alluded to with this individual, Smadi, is the self-radicalization on the Internet. Today, individuals do not have to travel to Pakistan to be understand the literature, be exposed to the literature, and to gain some of the information and knowledge on how you undertake attacks, whether it be IEDs or weapons. It can be done all on the Internet. And increasingly, we see those individuals are radicalized, self-radicalized, as being in the it's a huge problem for us. In the United States, there are a variety of ways that people become radicalized, particularly in the wake after September 11th for the 4 or 5 years after that. And it really is, to a large extent, the Muslim community, Muslim American community itself, if you're talking about international terrorism, who has alerted us to persons of who we need to look further at, and has understood that the worst thing that could happen to the Muslim American, Arab American, Sikh American community in the United States is another terrorist attack. And consequently, yes, we have outreach. Every one of our field offices has substantial outreach with and have since September 11th with the Muslim communities there. But in addition to the outreach, in addition to the relationships that we establish, the education that we do jointly, it is in large part attributable to the Muslim community itself that local radicalization is somewhat diminished, and really it's on the Internet where we face our biggest challenge now.
Director, several government officials have raised questions about the relationship between contractors and the federal government, and this is an issue that implicates perhaps not only the Department of Defense, the State Department, and many other government agencies, but also to some degree our law enforcement agencies. So what is your take on what would be the philosophy of the FBI when it comes to the use of contractors?
Well, there are certain roles that contractors need to play. There may be an area of expertise, one that we need. On the one hand, you need contractors in discrete areas. On the other hand, you don't want to overuse contractors and abuse it because they're far more expensive, bottom line. One of the problems for a period of time in the Bureau was we thought FBI agents could do everything. It doesn't make any difference whether it's your human resources or your information technology. Agents can come from diverse backgrounds. They can do all of it. But the fact of the matter is if you have to put in a new computer system, you need somebody who's a specialist on it. You may want them for that particular project but not want to hire them for a number of years. And consequently, whether it be contractors on a particular contract or contractors in particular areas, there is a role for them. It can be abused. They can be overused. All of us who are facing now the budget crunch are looking very closely at the use of contractors and making certain that you use them when you really need them, as opposed to it being the easier way to go.
You mentioned earlier the relationship between the FBI and Congress, a very important relationship. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the relationship between the Justice Department and the White House, but in very general terms. So let me preface that by saying, of course, that there's been attention to some of the drama surrounding conflict between former Deputy Attorney General Comey and other senior Justice Department officials in the Bush White House involving an NSA program in the previous administration. So with that as general backdrop, I would just note that, of course, the FBI is in a very interesting position in our government. On the one hand, it's undoubtedly an executive agency, and Article 2 of the Constitution vests executive power in the president. On the other hand, the FBI is designed to be somewhat insulated from day-to-day interference from people who are engaged in the political affairs of the nation. So how would you describe the relationship, or what you would maybe say is the ideal relationship between a president and an agency like the FBI?
Well, it's an interesting question. I would say, as I was saying before, that one of the great things about my job is I have to be aggressively apolitical, which is wonderful. But we as an agency need, in order for us to be effective, need the trust of the American people in the work that we do. And understanding that whatever we do in terms of investigations, whatever we do as the Bureau, is done without regard to a party or politics or what have you, that we are independent. It was somewhat easier prior to September 11th, where you had criminal cases on the one hand, and national security was all something that was handled elsewhere by the CIA, DOD, and State Department. And so there was very little interaction with the White House prior to September 11th. But the fact of the matter is that the president is the commander-in-chief. The fact of the matter is the president is responsible for the safety of persons within the United States and has a right to know what is being done to prevent terrorist attacks. And so for the first maybe 4 or 5 years, I briefed President Bush just about every day. Since that time, and it's on discrete areas relating to national security. And the impact of cases now that not only impact national security, but impact relationships with countries. As an example, we recently arrested an individual, an Iranian-American, who had, according to the indictment, plotted to utilize an individual associated with a Mexican cartel to kill the Saudi ambassador, assassinate the Saudi ambassador in Washington, D.C. Well, that quite obviously implicates somewhat more than a criminal case. And consequently, the impact on international relations, whether it be with Saudi Arabia or Iran or what have you, it is implicated in terms of what we do. And consequently, there is an exchange and understanding of what is going to happen, although the Justice Department ourselves will do what we believe is best regardless of that. Nonetheless, there has to be a dialogue on the implications and impact of a case such as that. And so the relationship has evolved over a period of time. It goes without saying that the President and others have not interfered with investigations that have to be handled independently. And so that stricture is still there and adhere to, but on the other hand, because of the, again, globalization, the seeping across or weeping across of information and impact of cases, there has to be a different dialogue now than there was prior to September 11th.
Very interesting issues for you and for me. And I should just note that, of course, part of what makes this so challenging to live through and to teach is that history shows us, going back 30, 40 years, that sometimes folks in the White House are in positions where they take points of view and argue for actions that may not always be completely consistent.
I'm not going to say they're always happy with us. Not at all.
Indeed. Going back for a moment to the issue of the many balls that the FBI has to keep in the air at the same time, we have a number of questions about the investigation of financial fraud, and this is certainly a challenging time in which to be working in that space. So could you say a little bit about what priority the FBI is placing on financial fraud, mortgage-backed securities-related investigations, or anything of that nature?
Well, that is one of our main priorities. It has been since 2001. It was before then. But what you find is financial fraud go up and down in waves. And in the wake of in 2001, 2002, 2003, we had a wave of cases that I alluded to, the Enron case, HealthSouth, WorldCom. A number of these large corporations where billions were lost in terms of shareholders' value with the cooking of the books. We had a very large inventory back in 2002. We've worked that one off. And then comes the mortgage fraud crisis. We now have, I think it's close to 3,000 mortgage fraud investigations across the country. And again, it's prioritizing them and working through that inventory. And we have a number of investigations. Many of you have seen them on Wall Street in New York. Madoff being an obvious one, but also those relating to insider trading that we continue to handle. And we will get through this this surge in cases in the next 2 or 3 years, but I can guarantee you 4 or 5 years down the road there will be another scheme that we hope to anticipate, but another way of making money illegally in what you would call white collar. And so we beef up to address the wave as it comes, but we hope to do a better job down the road with intelligence to anticipate the next wave and hopefully address it before it really gets going.
We have a number of questions about what advice you might have for people entering public service, just beginning their careers. But I want to broaden that question and just note that all of us who have worked in government have come across extraordinary individuals who are public servants, who work very hard, who take personal risks in some cases, who go beyond the call of duty, and that is a great credit to our country. But it's also true that attracting and retaining wonderful people is difficult. So I wanted to hear a little bit about how you've approached the challenge of attracting and retaining excellent people at the FBI and how that's changed during your time as director.
Now, people do ask me, what you know, on your career, what do you do? I had a high school student at one point, and I understood I went to Princeton, and said, and his question was, Director, can you get me into Princeton? And I said, no, but I can get you in the Marine Corps, which would be far better for you in any event. But we're lucky at the Bureau. We had, I think, 50,000 applicants to be special agents last year, and we took maybe close to 900 to 1,000. And one of the interesting things, a debate or dialogue I've had with myself over a period of time, is the average age of a starting FBI agent is 30. And when I first came on, I said, well, boy, that's, you know, you can retire at 50, you do 20 years plus. It really precludes us from doing the type of recruiting on campus that other agencies did. And over a period of time, I come to find out that for us, we need the experience that we get in having people that come in from other careers. We've got a number of persons done fairly well, legitimately and honestly, on Wall Street, who have come with us and are now doing the investigations, the SEC the securities fraud, the insider fraud, the investigations. We had, back in the anthrax attacks in 2002, we had approximately 1,000 individuals throughout the United States who had in some way, shape, or form addressed anthrax in the course of their studies, persons we had to interview. Well, if you're going to do an interview of somebody who's handling anthrax, you want either a biochemist or somebody who has both the background as well as the investigative capability techniques to do that questioning. And so we have brought in chemists, biologists, persons with area studies, language skills, engineers, and they all had a career beforehand, which has been important to giving us the breadth that we need to address the threats that we talk about today. But perhaps more than anything else, I've come to believe that really the power that you give a special agent with a badge and a gun to affect persons' lives is substantial. And what you want primarily is persons with judgment and a good decision-making ability, and the persons who have had another career, persons who are a little bit older, tend to, we believe, exercise and exhibit that judgment, which is so necessary to what we do. Let me just pass one last thing in terms of public service. And everybody sitting at the table, I've got a number of assistant United States attorneys. Almost all of them have been in public in the U.S. Attorney's Office before. Some of them are still in private practice. Good luck to them. We all bounce, a number of us have bounced back and forth, but I think all of us would say the most rewarding times that we have had has been that period of time we're in public service, where you're given the opportunity to contribute. It really is a gift. It's a gift that I've had, is the opportunity to do this kind of work.
If the challenge of attracting and retaining great people is one that cuts across administrations where you've served, another one is responding to concerns that have been raised about the Patriot Act. And I wanted to just give you a chance to say a little bit about what the FBI, in your view, has learned about the Patriot Act since it passed.
Well, it goes back to what I said. The breaking down, the greatest benefit of the Patriot Act was to break down the statutory walls between the FBI and the CIA. Those walls were erected some time ago, where what you did internationally had very little bearing at what was done domestically and vice versa. But in this day, I'll go back to globalization, you cannot get a picture of a threat, whether it be a cyber threat or actually a narcotics threat, or trafficking in persons, or child pornography, terrorism, espionage, by looking at it solely on the one hand from the domestic perspective and on the other hand from the international perspective. You absolutely have to integrate that knowledge and that intelligence in order to be effective in this day and age. And the great benefit of the Patriot Act is it broke down those walls. Prior to the Patriot Act, within the Bureau, those who were doing the national security work could not talk to the criminal agents and vice versa. Much less have persons in the FBI talk to the CIA or NSA or others and vice versa. And the great benefit of the Patriot Act is to do away with that and enable us to build those relationships, change that culture, and understand that in order for us to be successful, we had to work very closely together on any number of these threats.
Is there anything you would add for folks who are particularly concerned about national security letters?
National security letters was a opportunity, not an opportunity, but a device was given to us to gather information not content of telephone calls, but the existence of a telephone call. And we had a procedure that we needed to follow, and in most cases we did, but in a number of cases we did not have the procedures. We moved ahead very quickly in the wake of September 11th and did not put into place the procedures to assure that we had the proper paperwork and the proper foundation laid in requesting those letters. We have, number one, we have put into place a software program and assures that you have the appropriate foundation before you ever issue a national security letter. We've had training and we have continuous oversight on that particular issue. In the overall context of things, it was not that we were doing something and getting information to which we were not entitled. What we did not do is put into place the predicates that we should have to assure to those looking at that we did have the appropriate predicate. And we have resolved that issue.
We have a number of questions that want to understand what your life is like day to day. And I wonder if you could just share a little bit about what a quote-unquote typical day in the life of an FBI director is like. Typical.
Well, you get generally now it's early in the morning, 7 o'clock or so, I'll start getting the briefing books. I'll have the first briefing at 7:45. When people come in, then we'll have a briefing generally about 8:30 with the Attorney General, elements of the agency. And then I'll have early meetings, and then the rest of the day I spend either out in the field visiting offices. A number of issues come within Washington that you have to address, national security issues that come up. And so it's a series, generally a series of meetings. What is driven, I mean, the fact of the matter is, what has driven us in the last 10 years is the threat of terrorism, which is why we spend the first hour or two of every day addressing terrorism. And one of the things people will ask about, well, how do you manage this? And I occasionally say not very well, particularly when those who think that I shouldn't be micromanaging. People, all the management books out there, they will tell you that you should be on the balcony, not on the dance floor, that you're responsible for vision and all the rest of that stuff. And I agree with that generally. But there are two areas where if you spend attention on it, you hopefully will not mess up too badly. One of them is terrorism and the necessity to make certain. If I've got to brief the president, which I still do every other week or so, I have to know and be knowledgeable in order to respond to the questions that President Obama has, as I did for President Bush. And that means making certain that my organization puts me in a position to be able to respond to that. The other area where I have not done as good a job is when it's bringing in information technology. And the necessity, we had early on an occasion we were putting a new case management system in, and I did not ask the hard questions. Somebody, I was told that, okay, we've got this system, it's going to go, we're going in July, whatever it is, we're going to flip a switch. And inevitably I said in the back of my mind, how's that going to happen? And on the one hand, you have what I call, pardon me for those who are technologists, others call them geeks, but the technologists who know the software, know how to do this and develop it. On the other hand, you have the people that know and understand the business practices. And the challenge is trying to upgrade the business practices while you bring on new information technology, utilizing persons who know the technology but do not know and understand the nuances of the business practices. And what I learned then is I have to be much more involved, and they have to convince me that what's happening is right in order to for it to go forward. So the two areas where I spend substantial time during the day, people who don't like it would accuse me of micromanaging, is terrorism and information technology.
Since you mentioned briefing the two presidents that you've worked very closely with, we do have some questions that ask about how you might assess the similarities and differences between President Obama and President Bush.
Actually, it's not that different. people from the outside will say, it's this way. I would tell you both individuals and the persons around them care about one thing, and that's protect the American public. You get in that seat, everything else is secondary. And both presidents evince exactly the same desire to assure that the American public is kept safe. Maybe different in nuanced ways in terms of how they ask questions and the like, but I can tell you there, in terms of the desire to protect the American public, there is no difference whatsoever.
Washington is a famously complicated place when it comes to agencies working together. You've said a little bit about the FBI and the CIA and their improved relationship. What might you say about the current state of the interagency process, which of course has a component for the FBI of being within DOJ, but then also across agencies?
Yeah, it's you get out in the field and over a beer, a glass of wine or something, all those differences disappear. It's really back in Washington where those you have much more of the butting of heads or issues relating to agencies. I will tell you, one of the we used to butt heads a little bit with DEA, but once we that was no longer a priority, we don't butt heads with DEA at all anymore, oddly enough. But the greatest transformation, I think, has been in the relationships with the international and the intelligence communities, the CIA, DIA, Defense Intelligence Agency, National Security Agency, and the willingness to sit down, exchange information, understanding the lanes in the road, understanding that we collect under different authorities. CIA and NSA collect overseas under, some would call them looser authorities because they're not affecting United States citizens. We have the responsibility of doing the investigation, the intelligence gathering in the United States, understanding that it's American citizens that we are operating, we are attempting to protect, and we have to do it under the Constitution and the applicable statutes. But getting aside the authorities, the sharing of that information, and working together has gone light years since September 11th. And I would say, having been through a number of these battles over the years, that the focus on the mission trumps just about everything else. I will say what is very difficult is coming up with an organizational structure to address cyber in all of its manifestations. Cyber being, because of the Internet, you had those fraud schemes we used to call wire fraud, mail fraud, and the like. No longer. It's all on the Internet. So fraud schemes, dissemination of child pornography, and the like have migrated to the Internet and could be called in the field of cyber. Cyber intrusions, the attacks, the exfiltration of information is also in the cyber arena. And how we organize and address that, both internally in the Bureau, but also throughout the government, is going to be a huge challenge in the years to come.
Unfortunately, we're about to run out of time, so I'm going to ask you, well, rather than one last question, three very brief questions, and you can take the last minute you have to address any piece of this that you like. Since you have such a very serious job, what do you do for fun or to relax? I will note that that seems to make an assumption that I'm not sure is confirmable about time to relax. Related to that, have you seen the movie J. Edgar? And related to that, when the movie Mueller comes out, what is your view of who should play you?
Now, let me take the last first. It ain't happening, so don't worry. On terms, no, I have not seen J. Edgar. And going back to number one, I ride bikes, play golf, and read.
Our thanks to FBI Director Robert Mueller. We also thank our audience here and on the radio, television, and the Internet. We want to ask all of you who are in the room to please remain seated at the conclusion of the program until the director has left the room. I'm Professor Mariano Florentino Cuellar of Stanford University, former Special Assistant to the President for Justice and Regulatory Policy. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.